Previously, I talked about the Hebrew word hodesh, and I want to begin talking about God's distinctness based on this word kodesh, because when you look at God's holy other aspect of transcendence, kodesh becomes basically what you're really talking about. Now, we, from our more or less Christian Western background, we develop an idea of holiness which is associated perhaps with notions of purity and morality and ethics and things like that. I do not want to take that and just totally throw it in the garbage can, but that is not the primary biblical concept of holiness. And so what I want to do is talk about for a minute what holiness is and the characteristics of holiness when we think about it in terms of God. So yesterday I said something about the fact that the word kodesh in Hebrew actually means condemned. And the idea is that something that was holy to God was condemned in the sense that humans could never use it again. And so the word tends to mean separateness, complete and total separateness, as unique and totally separate from the human sphere. And this was the case of God, that he is totally separate from the human sphere. And you find some passages in the Old Testament, I am not a man, and my ways are higher than your ways, and things of this nature. You can take a concordance and look it up, and you'll find passages like that in the Old Testament. Well, the fact is then that God is completely separate from humans, but yet it's God's choice and God's desire and God's plan to have a relationship with the humans that he originally created. And you see this going all the way back to the Garden of Eden. If you remember, after God created Adam and Eve, he would walk with them in the garden in the cool of the evening. And I mean, in my mind, I picture a parent with a daughter in one hand, 2 or 3 years old, and a son in the other hand, about 2 or 3 years old, and they're walking along in a garden or on the beach or something like that, and you know how the kids are. They'll hold your hand a little while, they'll run off, they'll play, they'll do things, and then they come back and they'll walk with you a little more, and so on. That's my visual image of God walking with Adam and Eve in the garden in the cool of the evening. The reality of that passage is that God created man for fellowship with himself. And that's what they were doing. They were interacting, they were interrelating man, the creation, with God, the creator. And this was the original state of man until what we know as the fall. And as a result of the fall, then, there was this complete separation that was introduced between God and man. And no longer did God walk with Adam and Eve in the garden in the cool of the evening. No longer did Adam and Eve even live in the garden. But they were sent out of the garden to the east. And that was when the human existence as we think of it today began to take place, which, if I remember right, is by the end of Genesis 3. So the reality of all of this is that God became completely separate from humans in the garden as a result of sin. Not God's sin, but the presence of sin that came into the world as a result of what Adam and Eve did. So, initially, the holiness of God, the separateness of God, was not related to things like moral purity or religious purity or ethical purity or any of these sorts of things. It was simply the fact that God was separate from fallen humanity. And so when you look at the holiness of God, this is the main concept. God is separate from a fallen humanity, a humanity for which there is sin. And so these distinctive characteristics that are up on the board are some of the things that clearly identify God as separate from humanity. The first is simply the transcendence. God is qualitatively not human. God is unique, and he's present by his spirit. The reality of God's existence is reflected in all of creation. But God is not in the animals or the trees or any of these things. But rather, God is away from these things, and they simply reflect his existence. God is unapproachable. The main idea of unapproachableness is that God is completely distinct. If God chooses to shut himself off from a human or humans, there is no way that person would ever be able to approach God. God is distinct from humans. He is distinct from angelic beings. He is distinct from his creation. And God's presence is by invitation only. Not you inviting God into your heart, but God inviting you into his presence. And sometimes this is, I think, maybe a mistake that we make in the church when we talk about somebody inviting Christ into their heart. I know it comes from some symbol where Jesus says, "Behold," I guess it's Jesus in Revelation says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock, and if anyone hears my voice and invites me I will come in and sup with him and so on like that. But the reality is that when a person becomes a Christian, they are invited to participate in fellowship with God. And it's at that point that they are invited into God's presence. Why? Because through Jesus, sins are forgiven and all of these things. Well, in the Old Testament, unapproachableness is the idea that God's presence is by invitation only. And this is almost seen very clearly in Isaiah chapter 6. So if you want some homework tonight, read Isaiah chapter 6, because it's worth reading for illustration of some of the things that we've been talking about today. The presence of God is reflected in the cultic arrangements that were given to the Israelites, whether it's the temple or the tabernacle. If you take the entire system, the way it's structured, you see the way in which it communicates to the people the idea of inviting them into God's presence. The tabernacle and later the temple were laid out sort of in this fashion. There was a wall around the sacred area. Inside the sacred area, there was a building or a tent. Inside that tent, there was a room right here, which was the Holy of Holies, which is where the Ark of the Covenant rested and where it was believed that the glory of God existed. In this area, which was like the outer court to God's throne room, the Holy of Holies was like the throne room. So this was the outer court of the throne room. There was the altar of incense, where incense was burned representing the prayers of God's people. There was the table of showbread with one loaf of bread for each of the 12 tribes of Israel, so that they were constantly before the presence of God. There was the menorah, the seven-branched lampstand on which the fire, the light burned, a symbol of the presence of God's Spirit. There was the altar on which the sacrifices were offered. There was the area where the sacrifices were made, and there was a large source of water over there to be able to be used. And all around the area, there were priests. And the people had a single entrance by which they could come into the sacred area. And symbolically, at least, when they came into the temple or tabernacle, they were walking into where the presence of God was found by the invitation of God, because He created this structure to enable them to be able to come in and to stand before Him. And so this was the basic idea of the temple or the tabernacle before that. It was to provide a physical evidence of the presence of this transcendent God in the midst of the people. And the people were allowed, so to speak, by invitation to come in. Invitation because they were the people that God had redeemed and chosen for himself. And so they were invited to come into his presence. And later on in the Old Testament period, but after the end of the Old Testament, there were rules that were developed that restricted the ability of non-Jews to actually come into the actual temple area. And by New Testament times, there was a wall that was built all the way around the sacred area of the temple. And it said at each of the 13 different entrances into the temple area, entrance beyond this point is forbidden to non-Jews. If you enter past this gate, your blood will be on your own head. Which means if you're not a Jew and you were taken into the sacred area or you wandered into the sacred area, that you could expect for them to take you out and sacrifice you, so to speak. That is to say, kill you. You were not invited. That does not mean God did not invite you, but the Jewish people considered you not invited. They were the only ones invited into the presence of God in that particular kind of a situation. The place of regular temple activity is worth knowing about and thinking about in terms of unapproachableness. The main activity of the temple took place right here, because that is where sacrifices were made, and that is where the altar of God was on which the sacrifices were offered. And if you look at, let's say, a week-long period of sacrifices, you find that at a minimum, it involved a small flock of sheep that had to be sacrificed every week, because there were morning sacrifices and evening sacrifices for sin offerings. On the Sabbath, there were seven of those, and then there were other additional sacrifices that had to be offered as well. And so when you put it all together, it was a minimum of approximately 50 sheep that would be offered every week, in addition to personal sacrifices. So if you or I were to go into this area to present a sacrifice, we could do it if we were acceptable within the Jewish culture at the time. You could go in and you could offer your sacrifice here, and then the priest would then take the sacrificial animal and offer what parts of it were appropriate on the altar over here. And you would leave with the understanding that you had received whatever it was you had come seeking when you came into the temple. If it was forgiveness of sin, you had received forgiveness of sin. If it was cleansing of guilt, you had received cleansing of guilt. If it was for fellowship, or if it was for thanksgiving, whatever it was, you had received it by coming into the presence of God, offering your sacrifice, and then you would leave. Something additional that the whole concept of Kodesh relates to is that not only was God Kodesh, holy, but everything associated with him was holy, which meant that all of the utensils in the temple and the temple building itself and these sorts of things, they were all considered holy because they were all set apart and dedicated entirely to God. And the priests were holy because they had been set apart by God and entirely dedicated to serving him in the temple and all of the things associated with the temple. And so in its original idea, holiness meant separated and totally dedicated to God. And it does not, in a direct sense, carry the sort of moral and ethical and purity ideas that holiness today has come to attach itself to. But rather, it was simply what is holy and totally committed to God and God's use. And that's the fundamental concept of holiness. Okay, another one is the idea of kavod, or glory. This is the Hebrew for kavod. By the way, that's the Hebrew for Kodesh. Glory, divine glory, kavod, means to shine or burn brightly. And God's glory is a radiant glory that can reflect many things. It may reflect a sense of the terrible, the awesome, the fearsomeness, justice, rightness. It can reflect many things to people who see it. Depending on their own personal state, they will see God's glory in various different ways. In the Old Testament, though, the glory of God is often referred to in terms of the Shekinah glory. The Shekinah glory was, in a sense, the physical presence of God among the people. And it is said that when the tabernacle and later the temple was standing, even though the Holy of Holies had no light and no direct source of light whatsoever, there was continually, day and night, sort of a low, warm glow that existed in the Holy of Holies, which is associated with the idea of God's Shekinah glory, the radiance of his presence being seen in the Holy of Holies. The place where a person would go to stand in the very presence of God. And the presence of God for the Israelites and for the Old Testament was in the Holy of Holies, standing in the place where God's glory was seen and experienced. The high priest was the only person who was allowed to enter into the Holy of Holies. And that was again on the Day of Atonement. After the sacrificial goat was slain, part of the blood, half of the blood, was poured out at the altar. The other half of the blood was taken by the high priest into the temple building itself and into the Holy of Holies, and it was poured out on the Ark of the Covenant. Or later, when the Ark of the Covenant was no longer in the Holy of Holies, it was simply poured out in some location within the Holy of Holies. An interesting story from that time is that the priest, the high priest, would always wear some sort of a rope around his foot, and he would always have some bells at the bottom of his robe, so that as long as he was moving around, and he would keep moving around in the Holy of Holies, and as long as he was moving around, people would hear the bell tinkling and they would know everything was all right. But if somehow it fell silent in there and the high priest was no longer moving around, then it would be assumed that Yahweh must have struck him dead for some impure thought, some wrong action, something like that, and the rope was used to pull him out from the Holy of Holies because no one else could enter into the Holy of Holies except the high priest on the Day of Atonement. As far as I am aware, there is no record or no story of any high priest actually dying while in the Holy of Holies. But it was held in such high sense of fear and awe that when the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, the high priest actually literally did not know for sure, when he stood in the presence of God, whether he would come out alive or dead. And this was the concept which all of the people understood, and under which the priests operated when they were high priests going into the presence of God. God's glory is sometimes associated with divine judgment, because the glory of God is something that is, you might say, against, if you want, the acts of rebellion or sin or disobedience or something like that. There's also an important thing, I think, for us as Christians, just to add a little Christian sense to this. In Jesus' high priestly prayer in John 17, he says to God the Father, "I have glorified you here on earth by having accomplished the work you gave me to do." And so the glory of God is not just the sort of low light shining in the Holy of Holies. The glory of God is much more than that. It is an active action by God in accomplishing His will and His purposes here on the earth. And that is something that was part of the sense of Israelite faith that the glory of God was more than just that light in the Holy of Holies, but the glory of God was the reflection of God's presence fundamentally through the people Israel to the rest of the world. Righteousness is another aspect of God's holiness. Now, again, to us in the Western world today, righteousness tends to be associated with moral and ethical purity. But righteousness did not originally deal so much with moral and ethical purity. Rather, it simply dealt with justice. And righteousness was seen when God's wrath and his chastisement took place, which demonstrated the uniqueness of God as distinct from all of humanity. It sometimes has been interpreted as establishing a particular kind of order on the earth. That is to say, a government or a society of justice and righteousness. But for the Israelites, ethical demands and cultic demands of the law and the prophets emphasized most of all the spiritual aspects of their relationship to God and the fulfillment of the ceremonial aspects of the religious cultus. And there was some moral or ethical tone to this insofar as it reflected the nature and the character of God. Not necessarily human moral or ethical law or practices, but rather the nature and the character of God. So, for instance, you may find such things as social justice versus injustice. This is one of the things you see in the book of Amos, because Amos was from the kingdom of Judah, but Amos was a prophet who spoke to the people in the northern kingdom before its destruction by the Assyrians. And what he basically does is he criticizes the people for their social injustice and their failure to observe the law of God. And so such things as failure to observe the Sabbath, because the people apparently were open for business and operating their businesses 7 days a week rather than taking the Sabbath as a day of rest and to worship God. The wealthy women would wear all kinds of jewelry and wealth and so on like that, while the poor people were in the streets without food to eat and with without enough clothing to wear during the cold months and things like that. And so the prophet Amos criticizes the lack of righteousness among the Israelites in the northern kingdom on the basis of their lack of social justice, the injustice that was being done, and their failure to observe the laws and the commands of God, especially concerning the Sabbath. Truth is another area of God's holiness, and there are two words that I gave you there. One is amen, and the other one is Amunah, which refer to being steady, constant, persevering, and unwavering. And they reflect the idea that human trust and faithfulness are something that flow out of the character and essence of God. And truth, in other words, is from God. And human trust and human faithfulness are a response to the nature and character of God. And I think it's Paul who says to his readers in New Testament times, he says that even when we are not faithful, God is still faithful to us. And this is something that is an important thing, I think, for Christians, excuse me, to understand that even when we reach times where we find it difficult to be faithful as Christians, God is still going to be faithful to us. He does not abandon us. Well, the trustworthiness or the faithfulness of God is something that the people of Israel could depend upon. They could rely upon. They were God's people not because they chose to be God's people, but because God chose them to be His people. They were redeemed not because they had done things that would make God want to redeem them, but they were redeemed because God chose to redeem them. He honored His promises. He was faithful to His promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. These are some of the elements of truth and trustworthiness and faithfulness as regards the holiness of God. Divine jealousy is another area. And divine jealousy, again, there's a couple of words here, kina and kana. The notion is not that God is somehow threatened by excellence in some other god. And at this point, you have to listen to the idea that in biblical Old Testament times, people thought there were other gods. But God's divine jealousy is not because He is threatened by the other gods or excellence in the other gods or something like that. God is the source of excellence. Just like Jesus said one time when a person came up to Him and said, "Good Master," and Jesus turned to him and said, "Why do you call me good? Only God is good." You could take that a step further, I suppose, and say, God is the definition of good. And it's the same way. God is the source of excellence. God is excellence. And anything else is less. And God is not threatened by the idea of possible excellence in some other god, because He is the only one who is excellent and is the source of excellence. But divine jealousy relates to God's uniqueness. And the Hebrew words are essentially a reference to God's absolute right to maintain His uniqueness. And all other claims to the uniqueness have to be taken away. Whether it's Baal of the Assyrians, or Amun-Ra of the Egyptians, or the moon god of the Babylonians and the Assyrians, or whatever it is, all other claims to uniqueness are just nothing, because God is the one and only one that is truly, genuinely unique. And especially during among his own people, God has to be totally unique. And as we'll talk about later in a later lecture, the concepts of only one God, or a God that for his people is the only God, these are slightly different concepts, and you find both of these in the Old Testament. But I don't want to get too far into that right now. But divine jealousy is the fact that that God is unique, and nothing else can claim that uniqueness, because there is no other that is truly unique except God. A close corollary of this is that humans have no right to share what is God's with some other god, which for instance means that the people of Israel had no right to share their worship or their affection or their temple or anything else with any other god. Only their god was unique, and they were, as God's people, only to worship him because he was uniquely theirs. And so you see very clearly this sort of a choice put before the Israelites in the book of Joshua, when Joshua brings all the people of Israel before the altar of God at Mount Abel, and he says to the people of God, choose you this day whom you will serve. And if you read very closely, the people say, yeah, we'll serve God, we'll serve the Lord our God, we'll serve Yahweh, as well as other gods. And Joshua goes further, and he presses them until they finally commit that they will serve only Yahweh. Their initial response is, yeah, we'll serve Yahweh, we'll serve this god, that god, the other god, and so on. Joshua will not let it go until they commit to serve the one true, unique God. And this was the basis of Israel's difference from all the peoples around that were polytheistic.